Today, Gates v. Caterpillar. Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is James Baker. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Jerry Gates. This case comes from the district court on a grant of summary judgment in favor of Caterpillar in a Title VII case involving Mrs. Gates' termination from employment with Caterpillar after approximately 25 years of employment. Each side has submitted extensive briefs covering a lot of ground, and in the time allotted to me, I would like to, with the court's permission, speak to Ms. Gates' claim of retaliation. The district court, in granting Caterpillar summary judgment with respect to Ms. Gates' retaliation claim, concluded that the plaintiff could not present a claim under the direct proof method absent direct evidence of discrimination. And at the time Judge Mim made that decision, he was relying upon some language appearing in this court's decision in Stone versus City of Indianapolis. I think the cases which have been decided in the wake of Stone reflect that circumstantial evidence can be used to prove a case of retaliation under the direct method. And if the plaintiff produces evidence, circumstantial evidence, which might indicate to a reasonable jury that there was a retaliatory motive to the discipline, she is permitted to survive summary judgment and go to trial. And I would submit in this case, there is a body of evidence which does precisely that. It presents enough evidence in which a reasonable jury could conclude that this is a case of retaliation. I'd like to speak to that evidence if I might. The first piece of evidence, I think, takes us back to late January of 2002, and I think that's the pivotal beginning in this series of events. At that time, Ms. Gates had worked for Caterpillar for approximately 25 years, give or take a year, had had no prior discipline, had had at least acceptable and generally above acceptable performance evaluations. And Barbara Shane, the individual who performed human resource functions in the business unit where Ms. Gates worked, acknowledged that no supervisor had ever addressed to her concerns about Ms. Gates' performance. So we start with an employee who was, by all accounts, considered a good employee in Caterpillar. Between late January or mid-January of 2002 and March of 2003, we believe the evidence reflects that Ms. Gates engaged in conduct which would allow a reasonable jury to conclude that she was expressing concerns about her treatment because of her sex. Now, both Caterpillar and its briefing and the district court rejected the view that the plaintiff engaged in protected activity because she did not use the magic words, "I think this is going on because of my sex." What we have, however, is evidence that on at least two and perhaps three occasions during a period of some 6 weeks, Ms. Gates complained about how she was treated and her employment stature in terms of her job classification within the company, given the fact that a male employee doing similar work in another subunit of the business unit was in a higher pay classification. During the same period of time, she informed her supervisors that she felt she was subject to a glass ceiling. She also indicated on at least two occasions during this time period that she had reached the proverbial end of her rope, and if there were not changes that were being made, she was going to take her concerns to the next level. So I think a reasonable jury could conclude, taking all of this evidence collectively, that Ms. Gates was, if not using the exact word sex discrimination, or not saying this was because of my sex, certainly put Caterpillar on notice that she felt that sex was a factor here. I think the case law in this circuit is that she need not use the words sex discrimination or because of my sex, as long as she puts forth enough evidence which would make it reasonably apparent that that was her concern. And I believe a jury, considering that body of evidence, could conclude that Ms. Gates was complaining about her sex.
You know, the brief doesn't say much about her fellow employees' complaints, that she spent too much time on the telephone and the internet. Does she have any reason to doubt the veracity of Richard's claim that her fellow employees instigated his initial investigation?
She does doubt that, Your Honor, and the basis for the doubt comes from a couple of facts. First fact is that Richards would, on a periodic basis, and I think monthly, would receive telephone statements identifying phone calls made from the exchanges of each of the employees. And he indicated it was his common practice, if he felt there was an issue of abuse, that he would go to the employee and say, straighten up, cut it out. Ms. Shane, the human resource officer for this particular business unit, generally indicated to a supervisor that before you went to the level of engaging in discipline, if there is a behavior you want corrected or improved, at least consult the employee and talk about that. And that was a predicate, normally, to beginning any type of discipline. What we have here is that none of that occurred. Sometime in, as I recall, March or April of 2002, Mr. Richards asked that a formal investigation be conducted of Ms. Gates' telephone and internet usage, even though within this particular business unit, neither Ms. Shane, who did human resource functions, or the individual that conducted the investigation had ever engaged in that type of investigation of any employee in the past.
That's why it's so interesting, and why I wonder why the brief underplays that aspect of the case. In other words, why, you know, was she singled out for the phone and internet surveillance in the first place? And, you know, Caterpillar is claiming that her fellow employees complained. Did you get deeply into that issue?
Other than Mr. Richards in his deposition testifying that complaint was made, no, we didn't, for example, take depositions of other employees or secure affidavits from other employees.
And that brings me to another question, because it seems to me that there was some very basic statistical data that could have been looked at that would have been helpful in fleshing out this case. How many employees did Richard supervise? How many women? How many men? For how many employees, you know, had he ever initiated disciplinary measures before this time?
For telephone or internet abuse?
No, just disciplinary measures of any sort.
The record in this case reflects that Mr. Richards had been the supervisor of this unit for a relatively short period of time. I believe he came on board in the late summer or fall of 2001, and the proceeding involving Ms. Gates kind of spiraled beginning in February and March of 2002. So there was a fairly narrow timeline. I'm sure Mr. DeGroote will correct me if I'm mistaken on this point, but I believe the record does reflect the number of individuals in the business in this particular unit, and it was relatively few employees, somewhere between 4 and 6 employees, if I recall. And I think that if not all, most of those employees were female.
Do you agree that these numbers would show abuse of this? I think it's wise that Caterpillar has a policy that you cannot make any personal calls. So they have a reasonable policy. You can make them, but don't abuse them. But here, when you have almost 500 calls during a short period of time, and
actually
2,700 hits on an internet site at Bradley University. Pretty much.
You can make numbers say anything you want them to say.
Yeah, but what do those numbers say to you?
What the numbers say to me is that in a span of, as I recall, 3 months or 4 months, mm-hmm. Ms. Gates made 390 telephone calls that I believe were personal in nature. I may be a little off in the number, but
well,
approximately
almost 500.
I think the total calls were 480. The personal calls were about 390.
432 over 89 days. We all came up with different numbers.
Well, about a Judge Rover.
And I will too. But the point I would like to make here is that if one were to look at these calls, they occurred 60% of them occurred during the time period she normally ate lunch. Many of the calls, as I recall, nearly 90 of them occurred either before normal work hours or after normal work hours. And during this entire 89-day time period, Ms. Gates was averaging over 200 hours a month at work. So what this works out to is that in a given day, Ms. Gates' personal telephone usage, whether during lunchtime or before work or after work or during work, amounted to approximately 12 minutes. Her internet usage, which was virtually all of the internet usage, was for Caterpillar-sponsored education at Bradley University, worked out to about 28 minutes a day in days that were not restricted to a normal 8-hour workday. I'm kind of cutting into my rebuttal time, and unless the court has questions for me, I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Mr. DeGroff?
If it pleases the court, Chris DeGroff on behalf of the appellee Caterpillar. Before I get into what I want to talk about today, I did want to address your questions concerning the complaints. The statements of fact in the summary judgment pleadings below showed that they admitted, Ms. Gates admitted that these complaints were in fact made. And in a year and a half of discovery, not one deposition was taken of those folks. So yes, it was her female subordinates that initiated this whole look into her telephone usage and computer usage.
You know, I just find this so fascinating, this, because if you subtract the calls that were made before and after working hours and over lunch, it would come out to about 1.04 calls a day. And so what I'm wondering is whether her use of the telephones and internet have violated Caterpillar policy if all of the calls had occurred and the internet use had occurred before or after her assigned working hours.
Well, she was a salaried employee, and the policy itself doesn't make a distinction about whether the use was during a lunch hour, before or after. Recall that this was a period of time when Ms. Gates was complaining that she was overworked, that there was no way that she could possibly meet Randy Richards' production goals, yet at the same time she has her subordinates telling Randy Richards that she's spending way too much time on the telephone and on the internet. When they looked at those numbers, and the reports did came back from, it was Amy Winkler that did the reports, appellant in her brief states that at first blush it looks excessive. It's only after appellant's counsel has, parsed out the numbers as he has that, and as he correctly points out, you can make the numbers say anything. But there was also the nature of some of these websites. She or appellant discusses this being all related to education. There were tanning websites that she was visiting. There were joke websites that she was visiting. She was doing her taxes online at work. These are some significant concerns when she's at the same time complaining that she can't meet her quotas. So I guess I just raised that initially to address your point. But one of the problems that we see throughout the briefs and even in argument today is that appellant relies on this sort of blender approach when approaching this case and mixing up the claims of retaliation and discrimination and even the underlying suspension versus termination, and lumps all this together and asks you, the court, to tease out some sort of a material issue of fact. But with respect to appellant, confusing the issues is not the same as establishing a tribal issue of fact. And I guess another and related preliminary note I'd mention is there are a lot of things that appellant is calling facts that is just simply not supported by the record. There are
Before you get into that, let me just ask you about one fact that I'd like to clarify. Did Gates ever have an iPass card that would have allowed her to access Caterpillar's computer system remotely?
4 years. 1998, I believe, was the last time she had an active iPass card.
And that, fiance have that?
Her fiance did have an iPass card. And just so there's no confusion, an iPass card is one of those Clancy-like little cards that has a number that's constantly changing, that's linked into a computer. So you have every 10 or 15 minutes the computer password changes. So it's essentially the front door keys to Caterpillar's internal computer system.
Well, let me just be certain of this. Was that access turned off during her suspension or before that?
It had expired in 1998. She no longer needed to remotely access Caterpillar system for the work that she was doing. This wasn't something that Caterpillar flicked a switch. Now, bear in mind, she had her laptop. Her only computer was at work during her suspension. And she claimed that her iPass card, well, she claimed to Caterpillar at least, that her iPass card was in there too. Upon investigation, it turns out that appellant admits that she had it at home all along.
Speaking of being at home, although it probably isn't relevant to the discrimination claim, it does strike me a bit unfair that an employer can subject an employee to a suspension and spend the time investigating the employee and her activities and building a case for termination while simultaneously forbidding the employee from gathering her own evidence. What is an employee to do in defense of her job?
And let me address that. During the course of her suspension, Caterpillar was not building a case with respect to the amount of contracts she should be closing. As a matter of fact, had she not engaged in the misconduct she engaged in during her suspension, she may still be employed by Caterpillar today. Recall that her suspension was based on her overuse of telephone and internet use, and also that she wasn't meeting some closing goals. She was put on suspension for 5 days as a discipline method. It was only during that suspension that Randy Richards receives an email from Jerry Gates making mention of how unfair her suspension was. At that point, Randy Richards asks, how is she sending me an email? She's not supposed to have access to the computer. She doesn't have her computer there at home. That is what prompted them to take a look at, how is she doing this? They found out that it's
being... During her suspension, could she have contacted Caterpillar customers using a personal email account, not totally non-work related?
were out of the record here, but I would submit that that would still be wildly inappropriate. I don't think that there is an employer here today that would allow an employee to directly contact customers in an effort to bolster their case in an internal disciplinary matter.
Well, tell me this. Was she ever told not to contact Caterpillar customers?
The actual, and I can read you how the EAP is worded, it says, she will only have contact with her current supervisor if necessary, and will refrain from contacting team members and employees at TSD. And then
she got that at the start of her suspension?
Yes, in writing. And then Randy Richards, and this is all admitted, this is, I think, paragraph 74 and 75 of our statement of facts. Randy Richards specifically says to her, you are only to contact me, and then said, don't contact other people in the team. Now, what appellant suggests is, well, what that meant is I could contact anybody but the team, including our customers, which is, I fail to see that logic.
Well, did Caterpillar have its employees sign confidentiality agreements that would have covered this?
A confidentiality agreement saying that you are forbidden from contacting customers? Not to my knowledge. No. But, again, this is a situation where...
What in that paragraph makes you say that she could not contact her?
She will only have contact with her current supervisor if needed.
Yeah, but that's talking about... Her work and her.
During her suspension, she's only to contact her current supervisor.
So she can't contact a friend. She can't contact.
I see your point. I mean, we have First Amendment rights. I suppose that she would have been allowed to chat with her friend next door, of course. But I think that to put that in the same column as sending emails on cat with a cat logo with her cat email address to customers with whom she was working at the time and asking for specific information. Now, when I asked her in her deposition, if you would have told those folks why you were asking for that information, would that have been appropriate? She said, oh, no, I would never have done that. I mean, that shows that she knew she was doing something wrong.
My question to you was, how do you, what is she doing in defense of her job?
Well, she wasn't losing her job.
You've forbidden her from gathering her own evidence while you're gathering evidence. There's something...
And this, again, and I think this is part of the confusion that has been developed in this record, is the suspension and the termination are two separate reasons. During her suspension... you're asking what could she have done to collect information to combat her internet misuse or her phone misuse? Well, I suppose she could have done what her counsel has done on appeal and gone through and tried to explain those statistics. But they weren't gathering information that related to her contract closing rate. Rather, they were reacting to her misconduct during the EAP period. That they became aware of. So I guess I'm running low on time if I would entertain any other questions. I think that one particular point that really needs to be hammered home is there is no protected activity here. That's this sort of aggregate protected activity theory that Mr. Baker mentioned. There's absolutely no support for that. This is a classic 0 + 0 = 0 sort of situation.
So as long as she's at Caterpillar, even if it's before her work hours or after her work hours, she can't use the phone.
It's Caterpillar's phone. I'm not saying she couldn't use her phone. And again, as counsel was correct in saying that it was for reasonable use. But again, we're talking about Caterpillar's good faith basis for its employment decisions and non-discriminatory, non-retaliatory reasons. It gets this report that's an inch thick showing all these internet hits to twistedhumor.com, for example, or tanning sites. Of course they have some issues with that. Thank you.
Okay.
Baker.
Just a few points, if I may.
Could you start with twisted humor and tanning sites?
Great minds think
and,
a lot, Judge.
And taxes.
That's where I was going to begin. The technical service folks at Caterpillar did the analysis, and they found that the vast majority of Ms. Gates' internet usage related to Bradley University. There were a few.
On that point, Mr. Baker, I understand her attendance and graduation and support by CAT of Bradley involvement. Now, connect for me her internet usage of the Bradley site with their policy of you had mentioned before, of promoting this education.
Okay. Well, I think it all goes back to the fact, under Caterpillar's policy, non-abusive use of the computer is permitted. And that really means, sure, as long as it doesn't interfere with Caterpillar's business functions or the employee's ability to do the work. She was using it for 28 minutes during time periods when she was at the company for roughly 12 hours a day, or at least 10 hours a day. It was all done for purposes of an educational activity that was promoted by Caterpillar. And that was not unusual for personal usage. We had one supervisor, Mr. Coors, admit that he had used the CAT computer for personal dating services. Others would use it to look at the news and weather. Our point simply is that this usage was not abusive, and Mr. DeGroote's characterizations to the tax preparation service and the tanning service represented a very, very small, almost a negligible amount of her personal usage.
Yeah, but what does this record show us as to her usage versus similarly situated individuals? Don't we have to have some grasp of that to determine that there is an abusive aspect to the termination by Caterpillar?
Under the direct proof method, I don't think that's required. It would be nice.
I understand.
I don't think it's required, but in this case, we do have evidence of personal usage by other employees in the technical services unit. Now, these were employees who were not supervised by Mr. Richards, but they were individuals who were subjected to discipline at the direction or recommendation of Barbara Shane, who was the same individual that did it in Ms. Gates' situation. And what we find here is that there were several individuals, one in particular who had outrageous personal usage coupled with almost serial misbehavior, who received a very token amount of discipline.
Can we just take a moment, if we could, on this contact with during the suspension period? When you're suspended for 5 days or whatever that week period is, she returns at the conclusion of it, presumably as a reinstated employee.
Yes.
This contact with the employer, with clients of CAT, you don't think that's inconsistent with company policy? Forget about what you should only contact your, and she's an experienced employee here. Now, she's been with the company a quarter of a century. You're taken offline, so to speak, and you are representing that you're really a full-time employee, aren't you, when you contact clients? I mean, the normal understanding of the client contact would be that somebody from CAT is calling you.
I think in this case you have to look at two things. The first is why she did it, and the second is what she did. In the suspension papers, Ms. Gates was given some performance expectations. And one of those expectations was that she, in addition to a number of other duties, would, during the span of 7 months, close out 20 government contracts. Now, I don't profess to be an expert in this area. It's very technical. But the record makes it very clear The contract closeouts involve coordination of activities with various people in the government, and it's a very time-consuming, long, drawn-out process. Ms. Gates knew that her job was dependent upon reaching that particular goal, a goal that was over twice what had been set for her prior to engaging in this complaints about her job situation, and a goal which was four times what was imposed or expected of the individual who followed in her shoes. She knew that her boss was setting her up for failure. Or best case scenario for him was he was totally ignorant of what was involved in contract closeouts. So she felt compelled, as a reasonable employee would, in responding to that, to submit a rebuttal, which was consistently within her rights to do. And
you're saying she couldn't afford to lose that time? In other words, she needed to maintain contact during that week suspension to enable her to meet the goals of that had been set for her?
What I'm saying is she was very upset about what was done to her, was very upset about the goal, felt it was fairly important to take quick action in addressing the issue. The other thing that I think is worthwhile to note here is that Ms. Gates didn't go to these individuals and say, look what Kat's done to me. There are a bunch of jerks that are doing these things. She didn't demean Kat. She just asked for data to support her position as to what would reasonably be required to close a contract. And she was doing it only for the purposes of saving her job.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Thank you very much.
Did you have a concluding thought from a colleague? I don't want to cut you off.
No.
All right. Thank you to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And